sweetness? Was a sign of veneration required of her? If so, what? She lacked the knees for genuflection and the lips for hosannas. She couldn't stoop. She couldn't touch the relic. What was there left to do? Unless, God help her, she had to enter the thing. She knew the instant she'd formed the thought that this was precisely why she'd been brought here. She'd left her living flesh to enter this prisoner of brick, cord, and decay, a thrice-bounded carcass from which she might never emerge again. The thought revolted her. But had she come this far only to turn back because this last rite distressed her too much? Even assuming she could defy the forces that had brought her here and return to the house of her body against their will, wouldn't she wonder forever what adventure she'd turned her back on? She was no coward. She would enter the relic and take the consequences. No sooner thought than done. Her mind sank towards the binding and slipped between the threads into the body's maze. She had expected darkness, but there was light here. The forms of the body's innards delineated by the milk blue she'd come to know as the colour of this mystery. There was no foulness, no corruption. It was less a charnel house than a cathedral, the source, she now suspected, of the sacredness that permeated this underground. But, like a cathedral, its substance was quite dead. No blood ran in these veins, no heart pumped, no lungs drew breath. She spread her intention through the stilled anatomy, to feel its length and breadth. The dead woman had been large in life, her hips substantial, her breasts heavy, but the binding bit into her ripeness everywhere, perverting the swell and sweep of her. What terrible last moments she must have known, lying blind in this filth, hearing the wall of her mausoleum being built, brick by brick. What kind of crime hung on her, Jude wondered, that she'd been condemned to such a death? And who were her executioners, the builders of that wall? Had they sung as they worked, their voices growing dimmer as the brick blotted them out, or had they been silent, half ashamed of their cruelty? There was so much she wished she knew, and none of it answerable. She'd finished her journey as she'd begun it, in fear and confusion. It was time to be gone from the relic and home. She willed herself to rise out of the dead blue flesh. To her horror, nothing happened. She was bound here, a prisoner within a prisoner. God help her. What had she done? Instructing herself not to panic, she concentrated her mind on the problem, picturing the cell beyond the binding, and the wall she'd passed so effortlessly through, and the lovers, and the passageway that led out to the open sky. But imagining was not enough. She had let her curiosity overtake her, spreading her spirit through the corpse, and now it had claimed that spirit for itself. A rage began in her, and she let it come. It was as recognizable a part of her as the nose on her face, and she needed all that she was, every particular, to empower her. If she'd had her own body around her, it would have been flushing, as her heartbeat caught the rhythm of her fury. She even seemed to hear it, the first sound she'd been aware of since leaving the house, the pump at its hectic work. It was not imagined. She felt it in the body around her, a tremor passing through the long-stilled system as her rage ignited it afresh. In the throne room of its head, a sleeping mind woke and knew it was invaded. For Jude, there was an exquisite moment of shared consciousness, when a mind new to her, yet sweetly familiar, grazed her own. Then she was expelled by its wakefulness. She heard it scream in horror behind her, a sound of mind rather than throat, which went with her as she sped from the cell, out through the wall, past the lovers, shaken from their intercourse by falls of dust, out and up, into the rain, and into a night not blue, but bitterest black. The din of the woman's terror accompanied her all the way back to the house, where, to her infinite relief, she found her own body still standing in the candle-lit room. She slid into it with ease and stood in the middle of the room for a minute or two, sobbing, until she began to shudder with cold. She found her dressing gown and, as she put it on, realized that her wrists and elbows were no longer stained. She went into the bathroom and consulted the mirror. Her face was similarly cleansed. Still shivering, she returned to the living room to look for the blue stone. There was a substantial hole in the wall where its impact had gouged out the plaster. The stone itself was unharmed, lying on the rug in front of the hearth. She didn't pick it up. She'd had enough of its delirium for one night. Avoiding its baleful glance as best she could, she threw a cushion over it. Tomorrow she'd plan some way of ridding herself of the thing. Tonight she needed to tell somebody what she'd experienced, before she began to doubt it. Someone a little crazy, who'd not dismiss her account out of hand. Someone already half-believing. Gentle, of course. Chapter 17. Towards midnight, the traffic outside Gentle's studio dwindled to almost nothing. Anybody who was going to a party tonight had arrived. They were deep in drink, debate, or seduction, determined as they celebrated to have in the coming year what the going had denied them. Content with his solitude, Gentle sat cross-legged on the floor, a bottle of bourbon between his legs and canvases propped up against the furniture all around him. Most of them were blank, but that suited his meditation. So was the future. He'd been sitting in this ring of emptiness for about 2 hours, drinking from the bottle, and now his bladder needed emptying. He got up and went to the bathroom, using the light from the lounge to go by rather than face his reflection. As he shook the last drops into the bowl, that light went off. He zipped himself up and went back into the studio. The rain lashed against the window, but there was sufficient illumination from the street for him to see that the door out onto the landing stood inches ajar.
"Who's there?" he said.
The room was still for a moment. Then he glimpsed a form against the window, and the smell of something burned and cold pricked his nostrils. The Whistler. My God, it had found him. Fear made him fleet. He broke from his frozen posture and raced to the door. He would have been through it and away down the stairs had he not almost tripped on the dog waiting obediently on the other side. It wagged its tail in pleasure at the sight of him and halted his flight. The Whistler was no dog lover. So who was here? Turning back, he reached for the light switch and was about to flip it on when the unmistakable voice of Pai O'Pa said,
"Please don't. I prefer the dark."
Gentle's finger dropped from the switch, his heart hammering for a different reason.
"Pai? Is that you?"
"Yes, it's me," came the reply. "I heard you wanted to see me. From a friend of yours."
"I thought you were dead."
"I was with the dead. Teresa and the children."
"Oh, God. Oh, God."
"You lost somebody too," Pai O'Pa said.
It was wise, Gentle now understood, to have this exchange in darkness, to talk in shadow of the grave and the lambs it had claimed.
"I was with the spirits of my children for a time. Your friend found me in the mourning place, spoke to me, told me you wanted to see me again. This surprises me, Gentle."
"As much as you talking to Taylor surprises me," Gentle replied,
though after their conversation it shouldn't have done.
"Is he happy?"
he asked, knowing the question might be viewed as a banality, but wanting reassurance.
"No spirit is happy," Pai replied. "There's no release for them. Not in this dominion, or any other. They haunt the doors, waiting to leave. But there's nowhere for them to go."
"Why?"
"That's a question that's been asked for many generations, Gentle, and unanswered. As a child, I was taught that before the Unbeheld went into the First Dominion, there was a place there into which all spirits were received. My people lived in that dominion then, and watched over that place. But the Unbeheld drove both the spirits and my people out.
So the spirits have nowhere to go?
Exactly. Their numbers swell, and so does their grief.
He thought of Taylor, lying on his deathbed, dreaming of release, of the final flight into the absolute. Instead, if Pi was to be believed, his spirit had entered a place of lost souls, denied both flesh and revelation. What price understanding now, when the end of everything was limbo?
"Who is this unbeheld?" Gentle said.
"Apex Amendios, the god of the Imagica."
"Is he a god of this world too?"
"He was once, but he went out of the fifth dominion, through the other worlds, laying their divinities waste, until he reached the place of spirits. Then he drew a veil across that dominion."
"And became unbeheld?"
"That's what I was taught."
The formality and plainness of Pi O'Pa's account lent the story authority, but for all its elegance it was still a tale of gods and other worlds, very far from this dark room and the cold rain running on the glass.
"How do I know any of this is true?" Gentle said.
"You don't, unless you see it with your own eyes," Pi O'Pa replied.
His voice, when he said this, was almost sultry. He spoke like a seducer.
"And how do I do that?"
"You must ask me direct questions, and I'll try to answer them. I can't reply to generalities."
"All right, answer this. Can you take me to the Dominions?"
"That I can do."
"I want to follow in the footsteps of Apex Amendios. Can we do that?"
"We can try."
"I want to see the unbeheld Pi, O'Pa. I want to know why Taylor and your children are in purgatory. I want to understand why they're suffering."
There was no question in this speech, therefore no reply except the other's quickening breath.
"Can you take us now?" Gentle said.
"If that's what you want."
"It's what I want, Pi. Prove what you've said is true, or leave me alone forever."
It was 18 minutes to midnight when Jude got into her car to start her journey to Gentle's house. It was an easy drive, with the roads so clear, and she was several times tempted to jump red lights, but the police were especially vigilant on this night, and any infringement might bring them out of hiding. Though she had no alcohol in her system, she was by no means sure it was innocent of alien influences. She therefore drove as cautiously as at noon, and it took fully 15 minutes to reach the studio. When she did, she found the upper windows dark. Had Gentle decided to drown his sorrows in a night of high life, she wondered, or was he already fast asleep? If the latter, she had news worth waking him for.
"There are some things you should understand before we leave," Pi said, tying their wrists together left to right with a belt. "This is no easy journey, Gentle. This dominion, the fifth, is unreconciled, which means that getting to the fourth involves risk. It's not like crossing a bridge. Passing over requires considerable power, and if anything goes wrong, the consequences will be dire."
"Tell me the worst."
"In between the reconciled dominions and the fifth is a state called the Inovo. It's an ether, in which things that have ventured from their worlds are imprisoned. Some of them are innocent. They're there by accident. Some were dispatched there as a judgment. They're lethal. I'm hoping we'll pass through the Inn Ovo before any of them even notice we're there. But if we were to become separated..."
"I get the picture. You better tighten that knot. It could still work loose."
Pi bent to the task, with Gentle fumbling to help in the darkness.
"Let's assume we get through the Inn Ovo," Gentle said. "What's on the other side?"
"The fourth dominion," Pi replied. "If I'm accurate in my bearings, we'll arrive near the city of Padashokwa."
"And if not?"
Who knows? The sea? A swamp?
Shit.
Don't worry. I've got a good sense of direction, and there's plenty of power between us. I couldn't do this on my own. But together, is this the only way to cross over?
Not at all. There are a number of passing places here in the Fifth, stone circles hidden away. But most of them were created to carry travelers to some particular location. We want to go as free agents, unseen, unsuspected.
So why have you chosen Parashokwa?
It has sentimental associations, Pai replied. You'll see for yourself very soon. The mystiff paused.
You do still want to go?
Of course.
This is as tight as I can get the knot without stopping our blood.
Then why are we delaying?
Pai's fingers touched Gentle's face.
Close your eyes.
Gentle did so. Pai's fingers sought out Gentle's free hand and raised it between them.
You have to help me,
the mystiff said.
Tell me what to do.
Make a fist. Lightly. Leave enough room for a breath to pass through.
Good.
Good. All magic proceeds from breath. Remember that.
He did, from somewhere.
Now, Pai went on, put your hand to your face, with your thumb against your chin. There are very few incantations in our workings. No pretty words, just pneuma like this, and the will behind them.
I've got the will, if that's what you're asking,
Gentle said.
Then one solid breath is all we need. Exhale until it hurts. I'll do the rest.
Can I take another breath afterwards?
Not in this dominion.
With that reply, the enormity of what they were undertaking struck Gentle. They were leaving Earth, stepping off the edge of the only reality he'd ever known into another state entirely. He grinned in the darkness, the hand bound to Pai's taking hold of his deliverer's fingers.
"Shall we?" he said.
In the murk ahead of him, Pai's teeth gleamed in a matching smile.
"Why not?"
Gentle drew breath. Somewhere in the house, he heard a door slamming and footsteps on the stairs leading up to the studio. But it was too late for interruptions. He exhaled through his hand one solid breath which Pai Opa seemed to snatch from the air between them. Something ignited in the fist the mystiff made, bright enough to burn between its clenched fingers. At the door, Jude saw Gentle's painting almost made flesh. Two figures, almost nose to nose, with their faces illuminated by some unnatural source, swelling like a slow explosion between them. She had time to recognize them both, to see the smiles on their faces as they met each other's gaze. Then, to her horror, they seemed to turn inside out. She glimpsed wet, red surfaces which folded upon themselves not once, but three times in quick succession, each fold diminishing their bodies, until they were slivers of stuff, still folding, and finally gone. She sank back against the door jamb, shock making her nerves cavort. The dog she'd found waiting at the top of the stairs went fearlessly to the place where they'd stood. There was no further magic there to snatch him after them. The place was dead. They'd gone, the bastards, wherever such avenues led. The realization drew a yell of rage from her, sufficient to send the dog scurrying for cover. She dearly hoped Gentle heard her, wherever he was. Hadn't she come here to share her revelations with him, so that they could investigate the great unknown together? And all the time he was preparing for his departure without her. Without her!
How dare you!
She yelled at the empty space. The dog whined in fear, and the sight of its terror mellowed her. She went down on her haunches.
I'm sorry, she said to it. Come here. I'm not cross with you. It's that little fucker Gentle.
The dog was reluctant at first, but came to her after a time, its tail wagging intermittently as it grew more confident of her sanity. She rubbed its head, the contact soothing. All was not lost. What Gentle could do, she could do. He didn't have the copyright on adventuring. She'd find a way to go where he'd gone, if she had to eat the blue eye grain by grain to do so. Church bells began to ring as she sat chewing this over, announcing in their ragged peals the arrival of midnight. Their clamour was accompanied by car horns in the street outside and cheers from a party in an adjacent house.
"Whoopee,"
she said quietly, on her face the distracted look that had obsessed so many of the opposite sex over the years. She'd forgotten most of them. The ones who'd fought over her, the ones who'd lost their wives in their pursuit of her, even those who'd sold their sanity to find her equal, all were forgotten. History had never much engaged her. It was the future that glittered in her mind's eye, now more than ever. The past had been written by men, but the future, pregnant with possibilities, the future was a woman.
Chapter 18. 1. Until the rise of Isorderex, a rise engineered by the Autarch for reasons more political than geographical, the city of Patashoqua, which lay on the edge of the Fourth Dominion, close to where the Inn Ovo marked the perimeter of the reconciled worlds, had just claimed to be the preeminent city of the Dominions. Its proud inhabitants called it Cassia Ocassia, simply meaning the hive of hives, a place of intense and fruitful labour. Its proximity to the Fifth made it particularly prone to influences from that source, and even after Isorderex had become the centre of power across the Dominions, it was to Patashoqua that those at the cutting edge of style and invention looked for the coming thing. Patashoqua had a variation on the motor vehicle in the streets long before Isorderex. It had rock and roll in its clubs long before Isorderex. It had hamburgers, cinemas, blue jeans, and countless other proofs of modernity long before the great city of the Second. Nor was it simply the trivialities of fashion that Patashoqua reinvented from Fifth Dominion models. It was philosophies and belief systems. Indeed, it was said in Patashoqua that you knew a native of Isorderex because he looked like you did yesterday, and believed what you'd believed the day before. As with most cities in love with the modern, however, Patashoqua had deeply conservative roots. Whereas Isorderex was a sinful city, notorious for the excesses of its darker Kesperates, the streets of Patashoqua were quiet after nightfall. Its occupants in their own beds with their own spouses, plotting vogues. This mingling of chic and conservatism was nowhere more apparent than in architecture. Built as it was in a temperate region, unlike the semi-tropical Isorderex, the buildings did not have to be designed with any climatic extreme in mind. They were either elegantly classical and built to remain standing until doomsday, or else functions of some current craze and likely to be demolished within a week. But it was on the borders of the city where the most extraordinary sights were to be seen, because it was here that a second, parasitical city had been created, peopled by inhabitants of the Four Dominions who had fled persecution and had looked to Patashoqua as a place where liberty of thought and action were still possible. How much longer this would remain the case was a debate that dominated every social gathering in the city. The Autarch had moved against other towns, cities, and states, which he and his councils judged hotbeds of revolutionary thought. Some of those cities had been razed, others had come under Isorderexian edict, and all signs of independent thought crushed. The university city of Heswar, for instance, had been reduced to rubble. The brains of its students literally scooped out of their skulls and heaped up in the streets. In the Atzimulto, the inhabitants of an entire province had been decimated, so rumour went, by a disease introduced into that region by the Autarch's representatives. There were tales of atrocity from so many sources that people became almost blasé about the newest horror, until, of course,
Somebody asked how long it would be until the Autark turned his unforgiving eyes on the Hive of Hives. Then their faces drained of colour, and people talked in whispers of how they planned to escape or defend themselves if that day ever came, and they looked around at their exquisite city, built to stand until doomsday, and wondered just how near that day was. 2. Though Pai O'Pa had briefly described the forces that haunted the Inn Ovo, Gentle had only the vaguest impression of the dark, protean state between the dominions, occupied as he was by a spectacle much closer to his heart, that of the change that overtook both travellers as their bodies were translated into the common currency of passage. Dizzied by lack of oxygen, it wasn't certain whether these were real phenomena or not. Could bodies open like flowers, and the seeds of an essential self fly from them the way his mind told him they did? And could those same bodies be remade at the other end of the journey, arriving whole despite the trauma they'd undergone? So it seemed. The world Pai had called the Fifth folded up before the traveller's eyes, and they went like transported dreams into another place entirely. As soon as he saw the light, Gentle fell to his knees on the hard rock, drinking the air of this dominion with gratitude. "Not bad at all," he heard Pai say. "We did it, Gentle. I didn't think we were going to make it for a moment, but we did it." Gentle raised his head as Pai pulled him to his feet by the strap that joined them. "Up, up," the mystiff said. "It's not good to start a journey on your knees." It was a bright day here, Gentle saw, the sky above his head cloudless and brilliant as the green-gold sheen of a peacock's tail. There was neither sun nor moon in it, but the very air seemed lucid, and by it Gentle had his first true sight of Pai since they'd met in the fire. Perhaps out of remembrance for those it had lost, the mystiff was still wearing the clothes it had worn that night, scorched and blooded though they were. But it had washed the dirt from its face, and its skin gleamed in the clear light.
"Good to see you," Gentle said.
"You too."
Pai started to untie the belt that bound them, while Gentle turned his gaze on the dominion. They were standing close to the summit of a hill, a quarter of a mile from the perimeters of a sprawling shanty town, from which a din of activity rose. It spread beyond the foot of the hill, and halfway across a flat and treeless plain of ochre earth, crossed by a thronged highway that led his eye to the domes and spires of a glittering city.
"Parashokwa," he said.
"Where else?"
"You were accurate, then."
"More than I dared hope. The hill we're standing on is supposed to be the place where Hapexamendios first rested when he came through from the Fifth. It's called the Mount of Lipabayak. Don't ask me why."
"Is the city under siege?" Gentle said.
"I don't think so. The gates look open to me."
Gentle scanned the distant walls, and indeed the gates were open wide.
"So who are all these people?
Refugees?"
"We'll ask in a while," Pai said.
The knot had come undone. Gentle rubbed his wrist, which was indented by the belt, staring down the hill as he did so. Moving between the makeshift dwellings below, he glimpsed forms of being that didn't much resemble humanity, and mingling freely with them, many who did. It wouldn't be difficult to pass as a local, at least.
"You're going to have to teach me, Pai," he said. "I need to know who's who and what's what. Do they speak English here?"
"It used to be quite a popular language," Pai replied. "I can't believe it's fallen out of fashion. But before we go any farther, I think you should know what you're travelling with. The way people respond to me may confound you otherwise."
"Tell me as we go," Gentle said,
eager to see the strangers below up close.
"As you wish," they began to descend. "I'm a mystiff. My name's Pai O'Pa. That much you know. My gender you don't."
"I've made a guess," Gentle said.
"Oh," said Pai, smiling. "And what's your guess?"
"You're an androgyne, am I right?"
"That's part of it, certainly,"
but you've got a talent for illusion. I saw that in New York.
I don't like the word illusion. It makes me a geyser, and I'm not that.
What then?
In New York, you wanted Judith, and that's what you saw. It was your invention, not mine.
But you played along.
Because I wanted to be with you.
And are you playing along now?
I'm not deceiving you, if that's what you mean. What you see is what I am, to you.
But to other people?
I may be something different. A man sometimes, a woman others.
Could you be white?
I might manage it for a moment or two. But if I tried to come to your bed in daylight, you'd have known I wasn't Judith. Or if you'd been in love with an 8-year-old, or a dog. I couldn't have accommodated that, except...
The creature glanced around at him.
Under very particular circumstances.
Gentle wrestled with this notion, questions biological, philosophical, and libidinous filling his head. He stopped walking for a moment and turned to Pi.
Let me tell you what I see, he said, just so you know.
Good.
If I passed you on the street, I believe I'd think you were a woman.
He cocked his head.
Though maybe not.
I suppose it'd depend on the light and how fast you were walking.
He laughed.
Oh, shit, he said. The more I look at you, the more I see. And the more I see, the less you know.
That's right.
You're not a man. That's plain enough. But then...
He shook his head.
Am I seeing you the way you really are? I mean, is this the final version?
Of course not.
There's stranger sights inside us both, you know that.
Not until now. We can't go too naked in the world. We'd burn out each other's eyes.
But this is you,
for the time being.
For what it's worth, I like it, Gentle said. I don't know what I'd call you if I saw you in the street, but I'd turn my head.
How's that?
What more could I ask for?
Will I meet others like you?
A few, maybe, Pi said.
But mischiefs aren't common. When one is born, it's an occasion for great celebration among my people.
Who are your people?
The Yorhatemic.
Will they be here?
Gentle said, nodding towards the throng below.
I doubt it. But in Isodarex, certainly. They have a Kesperet there.
What's a Kesperet?
A district. My people have a city within the city. Or at least they had one. It's 221 years since I was there.
My God, how old are you?
Half that again. I know that sounds like an extraordinary span, but time works slowly on flesh touched by fates.
Fates?
Magical workings, fates, wantons, sways. They work their miracles even on a whore like me.
Whoa,
said Gentle. Oh, yes. That's something else you should know about me. I was told, a long time ago, that I should spend my life as a whore or an assassin. And that's what I've done.
Until now, maybe. But that's over. What will I be from now on?
My friend, Gentle said, without hesitation.
The mischief smiled.
Thank you for that.
The round of questions ended there, and side by side they wandered on down the slope.
Don't make your interest too apparent, Pi advised as they approached the edge of this makeshift conurbation. Pretend you see this sort of sight daily.
That's going to be difficult, Gentle predicted.
So it was. Walking through the narrow spaces between the shanties was like passing through a country in which the very air had evolutionary ambition, and to breathe was to change. 100 kinds of eye gazed out at them from doorways and windows, while 100 forms of limb got about the business of the day, cooking, nursing, crafting, conniving, making fires and deals and love. And all glimpsed so briefly that after a few paces Gentle was obliged to look away. to study the muddy gutter they were walking in, lest his mind be overwhelmed by the sheer profusion of sights. Smells, too. Aromatic, sickly, sour and sweet, and sounds that made his skull shake and his gut quiver. There had been nothing in his life to date, either waking or sleeping, to prepare him for this. He'd studied the masterworks of great imaginers. He'd painted a passable Goya once, and sold an Ensor for a little fortune, but the difference between paint and reality was vast, a gap whose scale he could not, by definition, have known until now, when he had around him the other half of the equation. This wasn't an invented place, its inhabitants' variations on experienced phenomena. It was independent of his terms of reference, a place unto and of itself. When he looked up again, daring the assault of the strange, he was grateful that he and Pi were now in a quarter occupied by more human entities, though even here there were surprises. What seemed to be a three-legged child skipped across their path, only to look back, with a face wizened as a desert corpse, its third leg a tail. A woman sitting in a doorway, her hair being combed by her consort, drew her robes around her as Gentle looked her way, but not fast enough to conceal the fact that a second consort, with the skin of a herring and an eye that ran all the way around its skull, was kneeling in front of her, inscribing hieroglyphics on her belly with the sharpened heel of its hand. He heard a range of tongues being spoken, but English seemed to be the commonest parlance, albeit heavily accented or corrupted by the labial anatomy of the speaker. Some seemed to sing their speech, some almost to vomit it up. But the voice that called to them from one of the crowded alleyways off to their right might have been heard on any street in London. A lisping, pompous holler demanding they halt in their tracks. They looked in its direction. The throng had divided to allow the speaker and his party of three easy passage. "Play dumb," Pi muttered to Gentle, as the lisper, an overfed gargoyle, bald but for an absurd wreath of oiled kiss curls, approached. He was finely dressed, his high black boots polished, and his canary-yellow jacket densely embroidered after what Gentle would come to know as the present Patashoquan fashion. A man much less showily garbed followed, an eye covered by a patch that trailed the tail feathers of a scarlet bird, as if echoing the moment of his mutilation. On his shoulders he carried a woman in black, with silvery scales for skin and a cane in her tiny hands, with which she tapped her mount's head to speed him on his way. Still farther behind came the oddest of the four. "Enalianak," Gentle heard Pi murmur. He didn't need to ask if this was good news or bad. The creature was its own best advertisement, and it was selling harm. Its head resembled nothing so much as praying hands, the thumbs leading and tipped with lobster's eyes, the gap between the palms wide enough for the sky to be seen through it, but flickering as arcs of energy passed from side to side. It was, without question, the ugliest living thing Gentle had ever seen. If Pi had not suggested they obey the edict and halt, Gentle would have taken to his heels there and then, rather than let the Nalianak get one stride closer to them. The lisper had halted and now addressed them afresh.
"What business have you in Vanair?"
he wanted to know.
"We're just passing through," Pi said. A reply somewhat lacking in invention, Gentle thought.
"Who are you?"
the man demanded.
"Who are you?" Gentle returned.
The patch-eyed mount guffawed and got his head slapped for his troubles.
"Loitus Hamriok,"
the lisper replied.
"My name's Zacharias," Gentle said. "And this is Casanova," Pi said, which earned him a quizzical glance from Gentle.
"Zuikor,"
the woman said.
"Di speakat te gloss?"
"Sure," said Gentle. "I speak at te gloss."
"Be careful,"
Pi whispered at his side.
"Bona, bona,"
the woman went on, and proceeded to tell them, in a language which was two parts English, or a variant thereof, one part Latin and one part some fourth dominion dialect, that consisted of tongue clicks and teeth tappings,
that all strangers to this town, Neo-Vanaeth, had to register their origins and intentions before they were allowed access, or, indeed, the right to depart. For all its ramshackle appearance, Vanaeth was no lawless stew, it appeared, but a tightly policed township. And this woman, who introduced herself in this flurry of lexicons as Pontiff Pharaoh, was a significant authority here. When she'd finished, Gentle cast a confounded look in Pye's direction. This was proving more difficult terrain by the moment. Unconcealed in the Pontiff's speech was threat of summary execution if they failed to answer their inquiries satisfactorily. The executioner among this party was not hard to spot. He of the prayerful head, the Nullianak, waiting in the rear for his instructions.
"So," said Hamriok, "we need some identification."
"I don't have any," Gentle said.
"And you?"
he asked the Mystiff, which also shook its head.
"Spies,"
the Pontiff hissed.
"No, we're just tourists," Gentle said.
"Tourists?"
said Hamriok.
"We've come to see the sights of Parashokwa." He turned to Pye for support.
"Whatever they are."
"The tombs of the vehement Loki Lob,"
Pye said, clearly scratching around for the glories Parashokwa had to offer.
"And the Merotiti."
That sounded pretty to Gentle's ears. He faked a broad smile of enthusiasm.
"The Merotiti,"
he said. "Absolutely. I wouldn't miss the Merotiti for all the tea in China."
"China?"
said Hamriok.
"Did I say China?"
"You did."
"Fifth Dominion," the Pontiff muttered. "Spiatit from the Fifth Dominion."
"I object strongly to that accusation," said Pai Opa. "And so," said a voice behind the accused, "do I."
Both Pai and Gentle turned to take in the sight of a scabrous, bearded individual dressed in what might generously have been described as motley, and less generously as rags, standing on one leg and scraping shit off the heel of his other foot with a stick.
"It's the hypocrisy that turns my stomach, Hamriok," he said, his expression a maze of wiles. "You two pontificate," he went on, eyeing his pun's target as he spoke, "about keeping the streets free from undesirables, but you do nothing about the dog shite." "This isn't your business, Tickraw," Hamriok said. "Oh, but it is. These are my friends, and you've insulted them with your slurs and your suspicions."
"Friends, Seat?"
the Pontiff murmured.
"Yes, ma'am, friends. Some of us still know the difference between conversation and diatribe. I have friends with whom I talk and exchange ideas. Remember ideas? They're what make life worth living."
Hamriok could not disguise his unease, hearing his mistress thus addressed, but whoever Tick Raw was, he wielded sufficient authority to silence any further objection.
"My dearlings," he said to Gentle and Pye, "shall we repair to my home?"
As a parting gesture, he lobbed the stick in Hamriok's direction. It landed in the mud between the man's legs.
"Clean up, loiters," Tick Raw said. "We don't want the Autarch's heel sliding in shite now, do we?"
The two parties then went their separate ways, Tick Raw leading Pye and Gentle off through the labyrinth.
"We want to thank you," Gentle said.
"What for?"
Tick Raw asked him, aiming a kick at a goat that wandered across his path.
"Talking us out of trouble," Gentle replied. "We'll be on our way now."
"But you've got to come back with me,"
Tick Raw said.
"There's no need."
"Need? There's every need. Have I got this right?"
he said to Pye.
"Is there need or isn't there?"
"We'd certainly like the benefit of your insights," Pye said. "We're strangers here, both of us."
The Mystiff spoke in an oddly stilted fashion, as if it wanted to say more but couldn't.
"We need re-educating," it said.
"Oh?"
said Tick Raw.
"Really?"
"Who is this Autarch?" Gentle asked.
"He rules the Reconciled Dominions from Isorderex. He's the greatest power in the Imagicka."
"And he's coming here?"
"That's the rumour.
He's losing his grip in the fourth, and he knows it. So he's decided to put in a personal appearance. Officially, he's visiting Parashokwa, but this is where the trouble's brewing.
Do you think he'll definitely come? Pai asked.
If he doesn't, the whole of the Imagicka's going to know he's afraid to show his face. Of course, that's always been a part of his fascination, hasn't it? All these years he's ruled the Dominions without anybody really knowing what he looks like. But the glamour's worn off. If he wants to avoid revolution, he's going to have to prove he's a charismatic.
Are you going to get blamed for telling Hammeryok we were your friends? Gentle asked.
Probably, but I've been accused of worse. Besides, it's almost true. Any stranger here's a friend of mine.
He cast a glance at Pai.
Even a mischief, he said. The people in this dung heap have no poetry in them. I know I should be more sympathetic. They're refugees, most of them. They've lost their lands, their houses, their tribes. But they're so concerned with their itsy-bitsy little sorrows, they don't see the broader picture.
And what is the broader picture? Gentle asked.
I think that's better discussed behind closed doors, Tik Raw said, and would not be drawn any further on the subject until they were secure in his hut.
It was Spartan in the extreme. Blankets on a board for a bed, another board for a table, some moth-eaten pillows to squat on.
This is what I'm reduced to, Tik Raw said to Pai,
as though the mischief understood, perhaps even shared his sense of humiliation.
If I'd moved on, it might have been different, but I couldn't, of course.
Why not? Gentle asked.
Tik Raw gave him a quizzical look, glancing over at Pai, then looking back at Gentle again.
I'd have thought that was obvious, he said. I've kept my post. I'm here until a better day dawns.
And when will that be? Gentle inquired.
You tell me,
Tik Raw replied, a certain bitterness entering his voice.
Tomorrow wouldn't be too soon. This is no frigging life for a great sway worker. I mean, look at it.
He cast his eyes around the room.
And let me tell you, this is the lap of luxury compared with some of the hovels I could show you. People living in their own excrement, grubbing around for food, and all in sight of one of the richest cities in the Dominions. It's obscene. At least I've got food in my belly, and I get some respect, you know. Nobody crosses me. They know I'm an evocator, and they keep their distance. Even Hammeryok. He hates me with a passion, but he'd never dare send the Nullianak to kill me, in case it failed and I came after him. Which I would. Oh, yes. Gladly. Pompous little fuck.
You should just leave, Gentle said.
Go and live in Parashokwa.
Please, Tik Raw said, his tone vaguely pained. Must we play games? Haven't I proved my integrity? I saved your lives.
And we're grateful, Gentle said.
I don't want gratitude, Tik Raw said.
What do you want, then?
Money?
At this, Tik Raw rose from his cushion, his face reddening not with blushes but with rage.
I don't deserve this, he said.
Deserve what? Said Gentle.
I've lived in shite, Tik Raw said, but I'm damned if I'm going to eat it. All right, so I'm not a great maestro. I wish I were. I wish Uta Musky was still alive and he could have waited here all these years instead of me, but he's gone, and I'm all that's left. Take me or leave me.
The outburst completely befuddled Gentle. He glanced across at Pai, looking for some guidance, but the mischief had hung its head.
Maybe we'd better leave, Gentle said.
Yes, why don't you do that? Tik Raw yelled. Get the fuck out of here. Maybe you can find Musky's grave and resurrect him. He's out there on the mount. I buried him with these two hands.
His voice was close to cracking now. There was grief in it as well as rage.
You can dig him up the same way!
Gentle started to get to his feet, sensing that any further words from him would only push Tik Raw closer to an eruption or a breakdown, neither of which he wanted to witness. But the mischief reached up and took hold of Gentle's arm.
Wait, Pai said. The man wants us out, Gentle replied.
Let me talk to Tik for a few moments, Pai said.
The evocator glared fiercely at the mischief.
I'm in no mood for seductions, he warned.
The mischief shook its head, glancing at Gentle.
Neither am I.
You want me out of here?
He said. Not for long.
Gentle shrugged, though he felt rather less easy with the idea of leaving Pi and Tick Raw's company than his manner suggested. There was something about the way the two of them stared and studied each other that made him think there was some hidden agenda here. If so, it was surely sexual, despite their denials.
I'll be outside, Gentle said, and left them to their debate.
He'd no sooner closed the door than he heard the two begin to talk inside. There was a good deal of din from the shack opposite, a baby bawling, a mother attempting to hush it with an off-key lullaby, but he caught fragments of the exchange. Tick Raw was still in a fury.
Is this some kind of punishment?
He demanded at one point. Then a few moments later,
Patient? How much more frigging patient do I have to be?
The lullaby blotted out much of what followed, and when it quieted again, the conversation inside Raw's shack had taken another turn entirely.
We've got a long way to go, Gentle heard Pi saying, and a lot to learn.
Tick Raw made some inaudible reply, to which Pi said,
He's a stranger here.
Again Tick murmured something.
I can't do that, Pi replied. He's my responsibility.
Now Tick Raw's persuasions grew loud enough for Gentle to hear.
You're wasting your time, the evocator said. Stay here with me. I miss a warm body at night.
At this, Pi's voice dropped to a whisper. Gentle took a half-step back towards the door and managed to catch a few of the mistiff's words. It said, heartbroken, he was sure. Then something about faith. But the rest was a murmur too soft to be interpreted. Deciding he'd given the two of them long enough alone, he announced that he was coming back in and entered. Both looked up at him. Somewhat guiltily, he thought.
I want to get out of here, he announced.
Tick Raw's hand was at Pi's neck and remained there, like a staked claim.
If you go, Tick told the mistiff, I can't guarantee your safety. Hammeryok will be wanting your blood.
We can defend ourselves, Gentle said, somewhat surprised by his own certainty.
Maybe we shouldn't be quite so hasty, Pi put in.
We've got a journey to make, Gentle replied.
Let her make up her own mind, Tick Raw suggested. She's not your property.
At this remark, a curious look crossed Pi Opar's face. Not guilt now, but a troubled expression, softening into resignation. The mistiff's hand went up to its neck and brushed off Tick Raw's hold.
He's right, it said to Tick. We do have a journey ahead of us.
The evocator pursed his lips as if making up his mind whether to pursue this business any further or not. Then he said,
Well then, you'd better go.
He turned a sour eye on Gentle.
May everything be as it seems, stranger.
Thank you, said Gentle, and escorted Pi out of the hut into the mud and flurry of Vaniaf. Strange thing to say, Gentle observed as they trudged away from Tick Raw's hut. May everything be as it seems.
It's the profoundest curse a sway worker knows, Pi replied.
I see.
On the contrary, Pi said, I don't think you see very much.
There was a note of accusation in Pi's words which Gentle rose to.
I certainly saw what you were up to, he said. You had half a mind to stay with him, batting your eyes like a...
He stopped himself.
Go on, Pi replied. Say it. Like a whore.
That wasn't what I meant.
No, please, Pi went on bitterly. You can lay on the insults. Why not? It can be very arousing.
Gentle shot Pi a look of disgust.
You said you wanted education, Gentle. Well, let's start with, may everything be as it seems. It's a curse, because if that were the case, we'd all be living just to die, and Mud would be king of the dominions.
I get it, Gentle said. And you'd be just a whore.
And you'd be just a faker, working for...
Before the rest of the sentence was out of his mouth, a pack of animals ran out between two of the dwellings, squealing like pigs, though they looked more like tiny llamas. Gentle looked in the direction from which they'd come and saw, advancing between the shanties, a sight to bring shudders.
The Nullianac.
I see it, Pi said. As the executioner approached, the praying hands of its head opened and closed, as though kindling the energies between the palms to a lethal heat. There were cries of alarm from the houses around. Doors slammed, shutters closed. A child was snatched from a step, bawling as it went. Gendel had time to see the executioner draw two weapons, with blades that caught the livid light of the arcs. Then he was obeying Pi's instruction to run, the Mistiff leading the way. The street they'd been on was no more than a narrow gutter, but it was a well-lit highway by comparison with the narrow alley they ducked into. Pi was light-footed. Gendel was not. Twice the Mistiff made a turn and Gendel overshot it. The second time he lost Pi entirely in the murk and dirt, and was about to retrace his steps when he heard the executioner's blade slice through something behind him, and glanced back to see one of the frailer houses folding up in a cloud of dust and screams, its demolisher's shape, lightning-headed, appearing from the chaos and fixing its gaze upon him. Its target sighted, it advanced with a sudden speed, and Gendel darted for cover at the first turn, a route that took him into a swamp of sewage which he barely crossed without falling, and thence into even narrower passages. It would only be a matter of time before he chanced upon a cul-de-sac, he knew. When he did, the game would be up. He felt an itch at the nape of his neck, as though the blades were already there. This wasn't right. He'd barely been out of the fifth an hour, and he was seconds from death. He glanced back. The Nullianac had closed the distance between them. He picked up his pace, pitching himself around a corner and into a tunnel of corrugated iron, with no way out at the other end. "Shite!" he said, taking Tick Raw's favourite word for his complaint.
"Fury, you've killed yourself!"
The walls of the cul-de-sac were slick with filth and high. Knowing he'd never scale them, he ran to the far end and threw himself against the wall there, hoping it might crack. But its builders, damn them, had been better craftsmen than most in the vicinity. The wall rocked, and pieces of its fetid mortar fell about him, but all his efforts did was bring the Nullianac straight to him, drawn by the sound of his effort. Seeing his executioner approaching, he pitched his body against the wall afresh, hoping for some last-minute reprieve, but all he got was bruises. The itch at his nape was an ache now, but through its pain he formed the despairing thought that this was surely the most ignominious of deaths, to be sliced up amid sewage. What had he done to deserve it? He asked it aloud.
"What have I done? What the fuck have I done?"
The question went unanswered. Or did it? As his yells ceased, he found himself raising his hand to his face, not knowing, even as he did so, why. There was simply an inner compulsion to open his palm and spit upon it. The spittle felt cold, or else his palm was hot. Now a yard away, the Nullianac raised its twin blades above its head. Gendel made a fist, lightly, and put it to his mouth. As the blades reached the top of their arc, he exhaled. He felt his breath blaze against his palm, and in the instant before the blades reached his head, the pneuma went from his fist like a bullet. It struck the Nullianac in the neck with such force it was thrown backwards, a livid spurt of energy breaking from the gap in its head and rising like earth-born lightning into the sky. The creature fell in the filth, its hands dropping the blades to reach for the wound. They never touched the place. Its life went out of it in a spasm, and its prayerful head was permanently silenced. At least as shaken by the other's death as by the proximity of his own, Gendel got to his feet, his gaze going from the body in the dirt to his fist. He opened it. The spittle had gone, transformed into some lethal dart. A seam of discoloration ran from the ball of his thumb to the other side of his hand. That was the only sign of the pneuma's passing.
"Holy shite," he said.
A small crowd had already gathered at the end of the cul-de-sac, and heads appeared over the wall behind him. From every side came an agitated buzz that wouldn't, he guessed, take long to reach Hamaryok and Pontiff Farrow. It would be naive to suppose they ruled Vanef with only one executioner in their squad. There'd be others, and here soon. He stepped over the body, not caring to look too closely at the damage he'd done, but aware with only a passing glance that it was substantial. The crowd, seeing the conqueror approach, parted. Some bowed, others fled. One said, "Bravo!" and tried to kiss his hand. He pressed his admirer away and scanned the alleys in every direction, hoping for some sign of Pai O Pa. Finding none, he debated his options. Where would Pai go? Not to the top of the mount. Though that was a visible rendezvous, their enemies would spot them there. Where else? The gates of Parashokwa, perhaps, that the mischief had pointed out when they'd first arrived? It was as good a place as any, he thought, and started off, down through teeming Vanev, towards the glorious city. His worst expectations, that news of his crime had reached the pontiff and her league, were soon confirmed. He was almost at the edge of the township and within sight of the open ground that lay between its borders and the walls of Parashokwa, when a hue and cry from the street behind announced a pursuing party. In his Fifth Dominion garb, jeans and shirt, he would be easily recognized if he started towards the gates, but if he attempted to stay within the confines of Vanef, it would be only a matter of time before he was hunted down. Better to take the chance of running now, he decided, while he still had a lead. Even if he didn't make it to the gates before they came after him, they surely wouldn't dispatch him within sight of Parashokwa's gleaming walls. He put on a fair turn of speed and was out of the township in less than a minute, the commotion behind him gathering volume. Though it was difficult to judge the distance to the gates in a light that lent such iridescence to the ground between, it was certainly no less than a mile, perhaps twice that. He'd not got far when the first of his pursuers appeared from the outskirts of Vanef, runners fresher and lighter than he, who rapidly closed the distance between them. There were plenty of travellers coming and going along the straight road to the gates, some pedestrians, most in groups and dressed like pilgrims, other finer figures mounted on horses whose flanks and heads were painted with gaudy designs, still others riding on shaggy derivatives of the mule. Most envied, however, and most rare were those in motor vehicles, which, though they basically resembled their equivalents in the Fifth, a chassis riding on wheels, were in every other regard fresh inventions. Some were as elaborate as Baroque altarpieces, every inch of their bodywork chaste and filigreed. Others, with spindly wheels twice the height of their roofs, had the preposterous delicacy of tropical insects. Still others, mounted on a dozen or more tiny wheels, their exhausts giving off a dense, bitter fume, looked like speeding wreckage, asymmetrical and inelegant farragos of glass and metalwork. Risking death by hoof and wheel, Gentle joined the traffic and put on a new spurt as he dodged between the vehicles. The leaders of the pack behind him had also reached the road. They were armed, he saw, and had no compunction about displaying their weapons. His belief that they wouldn't attempt to kill him among witnesses suddenly seemed frail. Perhaps the law of Vanef was good to the very gates of Parashokwa. If so, he was dead. They would overtake him long before he reached sanctuary. But now, above the din of the highway, another sound reached him, and he dared a glance off to his left, to see a small plane vehicle, its engine badly tuned, careering in his direction. It was open-topped, its driver visible. Pai O Pa, God love him, driving like a man, or mischief, possessed. Gentle changed direction instantly, veering off the road and dividing a herd of pilgrims as he did so, and raced towards Pai's noisy chariot. A chorus of whoops at his back told him the pursuers had also changed direction, but the sight of Pai had given heat to Gentle's heels. His turn of speed was wasted, however. Rather than slowing to let Gentle aboard, Pai drove on.